No one likes feeling trapped. We all know what it feels like, but of course we all resist it in so many different areas of our lives. But today I want to talk about the mind, what happens when our mind feels trapped. But before we get into that, I want to ask you about this right here. How many of you recognize this date? Does anybody know what happened on January 28th, 2014? In Atlanta, Georgia, this is a real "where were you" day. We now affectionately know of this date as Snowmageddon or the Snowpocalypse. Oh, I'm serious. I mean, it's crazy how if you were in Atlanta around that time, definitely over the next few months, you had a conversation over and over again. Hey, where were you that day? How did you get home? Did you get trapped that day? And let me just ask, I'd love to know, did anybody have a commute that day longer than 6 hours? Longer than 8 hours? Yes. 10 hours? 12 hours? How long was it? 12 hours to get home that day. Unbelievable. And you're not the only one. That happened for many people. Somebody say more than 12 hours? 20 hours? Are you being serious? That is crazy. But that's not, that there were other stories like that. I mean, that day, I know you remember that. People spent the night in Walgreens and CVS, which, oh, by the way, doesn't have the most lovely accommodations. But if you're going to stay somewhere, they've got everything you need. That's the great news, right? People stayed over at friends' house. They never could make it home. Unfortunately, people slept in cars. And it was all because of 2 inches of snow that shut our whole city down. And we felt trapped. No one likes feeling trapped. We all know what it feels like. None of us enjoy it. The question for the series is, what if our minds have us trapped? What if we're stuck in a mindset that is not what's best for us, that has actually trapped us? All of us woke up today. All of us are here today, maybe watching online, wherever you're from, with some kind of mindset, some kind of way of thinking. It's almost as if our thoughts, our thought patterns, our mindset, it's almost as if it's an operating system. You know how the operating system works, right? I mean, the hardware of a computer would be virtually obsolete. It would be as useful as a doorstop if not for the operating system that makes it work. And we all know that awful feeling when you get that blue screen of death on the computer because the operating system has said, no, I can't go any further. I can't do this any longer. I am done. What if our minds, in the same way, have actually trapped us? How do you know? The question of this series is, how do you know when a mindset has become a mind trap? And so what we're doing for 3 weeks is I've just selected, here's 3 very common mind traps that all of us have experienced at one form, at one time, in one form or another. Last week, we talked about the trap of the victim mentality, why it's so dangerous. Even though there are definitely things that happen to us that make us a victim, it's so dangerous to walk around in this world living out of that mindset, letting that operating system move us forward in life because it's a trap. Next week, we're going to talk about the all or nothing trap. What would it mean for us to escape that trap? Maybe life isn't just all or nothing. But today, I want to talk about a specific trap today that all of you know. Everyone at different points, different forms have been stuck in this trap. But in order to do this, I need you to play along, okay? So this is a game of participation. I'm not going to call on anyone specifically, but I would love for you to play along. I'm going to give you a scenario. I just made up 3 different scenarios that might just expose whether or not we find ourselves in the trap of negativity. The first one is this. Let's say you're getting your yearly physical. The doctor walks in. What kind of news are you expecting? How many of you would say, oh, he's going to tell me that I'm going to live till 100? Anyone? Okay. And how many of you were like, this is it. We're at the end. He's going to tell me I'm dying. Others of you. Okay. All right. Let's talk about this one. Let's say your phone rings late at night. Okay. This is hard for some of you to imagine because you're like, well, that would mean I'd have to turn my ringer on at night, which I don't do. So when you're sleeping, no one can get a hold of you. But let's just assume for a moment your ringer is on and someone calls you at midnight, are you thinking, how many of you would say, somebody wants to chat. This is great. And how many of you would be thinking, oh no, someone is dying? The rest of you. Okay. All right. Last one. This is my least favorite one, but this one is probably the one that exposes my negativity more than anything else. Let's say your boss sends you a text message and says, can you come by my office? How many of you would go, awesome, she's giving me a raise? There's like five of you. And I'm assuming the rest of you would go, this is my last day, I'm getting fired. Yes? Come on, hand up high if that's you. Thank you. And then how many of you, your worst nightmare is when the bubbles go away and you go, whoa, 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 you were going to say something. I don't know what it was, but you were going to say something and now I don't know. Not knowing is worse than knowing. I think there's some good news and some bad news. The good news is this is a great opportunity for us today to experience what freedom might look like from the negativity trap. The bad news is that I think all of us, from at one point or another, know what it feels like to be caught up in, to be locked up in the negativity trap. And so today I just want to talk about what would it look like for us to get free from it. Some of you are like, well, I'm just naturally free from it. Because as you know, there are two kinds of people in the world, right? There are people who are positive, and then there are people who are, yeah, realistic. Exactly right. Yeah. There are no negative people in the world. Any one of you that would, somebody has accused you of being negative, you've said, no, I'm not negative. I'm just realistic, okay? It's very different. I'm not being negative. I'm just telling you what's going to happen, all right? It's amazing how in life we end up paired up with someone who is at the other end of the spectrum. So my temperament, my wiring is just naturally fairly positive. My wife, though, she would definitely say, yeah, I am a realist. I will tell you what is actually going to happen. And so I'll give you a scenario for us that is very common and exposes a lot of our relational dynamic. Let's say once a year or so, we take a road trip out to Texas to visit her parents, and we've got a bunch of little kids, and so our van will just be trucking it down the road. But at some point, everyone has to eat. And so naturally, I will see this sign on the side of the road, the Cracker Barrel, where I'm like, who can resist, right? The chicken, the dumplings, the fact that they put them together in such glorious fashion. And so I'll make a suggestion. I'll say, why don't we pull over and let's just take a break and let's all eat together at Cracker Barrel. It will be a beautiful experience. And in my mind, I've got these visions of grandeur of us all just sitting around the table, having wonderful conversation. You know, at one point in my mind, the server comes by, the five-star server comes by and says, you must be five-star parents. How did you get your kids to behave like this? And so I say to my wife, I'll say, hey, we ought to pull over and go to Cracker Barrel. And she says, you can do that. I'm going to stay in the car. Because as we both know, that's not what actually happens. What ends up happening is two or three kids end up ordering food that they don't even touch. The rest of the children end up fighting. One of them's glued to the iPad with headphones in. One of them's standing on the table throwing that little golf tee game across the room. And the server will eventually come by, not to compliment our parenting, but to ask us to leave. Meanwhile, we'll walk to the car through that gift shop and someone will break something, the most expensive thing in that store that we will end up buying. And so my wife naturally goes, sounds like a great time. Let's do it. See, we all have these two voices going in our minds at all times. Do you ever talk to yourself? Is it just me? All the time, every single one of us do. There's this running conversation that we have with ourselves. And maybe you've got on one shoulder, you know, just the one that's leading the positive parade. And then on the other shoulder, you've got the one that's just offering a negative opportunity or option to every single scenario. What could happen? What might happen? All of the uncertainties of life. Well, you probably know that the reason why you haven't gotten the phone call is because there's something wrong. She didn't really like you. She's really gone. She's with someone else. I mean, all the reasons why. And we just naturally fill up our mind with negativity. And what's amazing to me about negativity is it's both addictive, but it's also contagious. The more we're around it, the more we're prone to it. Positivity is just, it's difficult, and it's becoming more difficult in our world. In fact, our world has become, wouldn't you say, just more and more negative. A lot of people think that our world is driven by Duncan, but I would say our world is really driven by fear. I mean, fear is what drives so much of our media, so much of our uncertainty about the future. And our mammal brain just naturally wants to run with the herd. Our mammal brain naturally is used to sharing threats with other people, establishing a common enemy, and then working together to stay protected from that common enemy. And if we're to step away from the herd to go see the threat ourselves, then we might just end up in the jaws of the predator. See, there's a reason why negativity abounds in us. And yes, positivity has a cost, but there's actually a benefit that's far greater, that outweighs the negative trap that we find ourselves in. In fact, just like we did last week we talked about this Old Testament character named Joseph. Today I want to talk about, I want to pick up right where we left off. We ended last week saying that you can't really talk about being a victim without talking about the victory that Jesus has offered to us. And we read this doxology out of Philippians 2. The author of that letter of Philippians, the letter to the church at Philippi, is written by a guy named Paul. And so today I just want to take a bird's eye view. I want to pull out a couple of different verses from that letter, the letter to the church at Philippi. My hope is maybe the only application that you receive from this is that you leave today and decide to read through the letter that Paul wrote to the church in Philippi. Philippians is a beautiful letter. And what's interesting to me, what's helpful for me, is he doesn't just say, don't be negative. No, he actually replaces it with something it's actually weightier. It's more meaningful than just optimism or just positivity. Because this is not just an easy problem that we're facing. This is a genuine trap. And if we're going to escape the trap of negativity, I think it's worth us looking at what kept Paul so positive. He's going to introduce us not to a new word, but to a word that we don't necessarily associate with negativity. He's going to say that if you want to get past your negativity, if you want to get out of the trap of negativity, what he chooses to do is he chooses to focus on joy. Not only joy when things are going great, and not even just joy in spite of our circumstances. No, he's going to say, and it seems hard to even understand or believe. He's going to say, there is a possibility for you to experience joy because of your circumstances. That there's a way, in fact, the way that you can escape the negativity trap is to choose joy no matter what you're in the middle of. And not only are we going to see him embody it, but we're going to listen to some instruction he gives on how we can actually experience it ourselves. But to get there, to understand Philippians, we have to understand the context in which he wrote it. Does anyone know where Paul was when he wrote his letter called Philippians? He was in jail. Yeah, some of you Bible trivia scholars nailed that one. You've been like, you're going to want me on your team when we play, all right? Yeah, he was in jail. He was in a Roman prison. This letter was written around 62 AD, scholars believe. And this letter was written to this church in this town where he had visited before. But he's in a Roman jail, a Roman prison, when he writes this letter. Dingy, foul-smelling, cold. And it makes what he says even more powerful when we understand that he was choosing joy in some of the worst circumstances of his life. Here's what he says in the first chapter. In Philippians 1, verse 12, he says this. He says, now I want you to know, brothers and sisters, and he's speaking to brothers and sisters, meaning people that have chosen to follow Jesus, that he considers in the family of God. I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. He's going to say, hey, there's something good that's come out of this. Verse 13, he says, as a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains. There it is. For Christ. Everyone knows. They've gotten the word. The word has spread that I'm in chains, but I'm not just in chains because I'm in chains. I'm in chains for Christ. And then he gives some examples of the good that has come out of this. In fact, this is where he makes the statement about finding joy because of the circumstances. Verse 14, he says, "And because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have now become more confident in the Lord. And they dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear." Not because they don't have anything to be afraid of. No, they actually do have something to be afraid of. Look at me. I'm in prison. Listen to me. I'm in prison. I get it. This is not what I would have drawn up either. But my confidence that God is with me, that God, whether in this life or the next life, is going to deliver me, that God hasn't left me, it's given everyone else around me confidence. It's given them confidence, and it's given them an amount of courage that they have never experienced before, where they don't have to be afraid of the things that most people are afraid of. All of this has happened because of my circumstances. See, he had so much joy, and we see it in so many different places in this letter. This is a very short letter. There's only four chapters. You can pardon the confetti. There was a real party here last night. Some of you were like, "Oh no, is that snow? Hurry, run. We've got to go home." Only in Atlanta. That's awesome. So just ignore the confetti if you can. There's at least 16 different places in this letter where Paul talks about the joy that he has. Yes, I'm in prison. Yes, I'm chained, maybe even to a Roman prison guard. But I'm just telling you, I can still choose joy even in the middle of this circumstance. I have joy for you. I have joy for what God's done. I have joy for what God is going to do. I have joy for who God is. And I'm convinced after reading Philippians a number of times that having joy in our life begins with the thoughts in our mind. If you want to get to that place where he was, this immense amount of joy, this overwhelming amount of joy, it begins with the thoughts in our mind. See, nothing replaces negativity like joy. Nothing gets in the way of our negative thoughts like joy does. And so he helps us out. In verse chapter 1, he tells us, hey, I'm in chains, and it's because of my chains that God is doing some really great things. But in chapter 4, at the very end of the letter, he's going to give us some instruction. He's going to say, hey, if you're interested in escaping the trap of negativity, if you're interested in setting your mind on something that will give you more freedom, then here's what you've got to do. He says, finally, brothers and sisters, finally, whatever is true, whatever's noble, whatever's right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, whatever is excellent, whatever is praiseworthy, think about such things. And this verb, think about, means to dwell on. It's an active state of consideration. Don't just think about it once and drive past it. No, let it be like a roundabout in your mind where you're just going around and around and around. Look, Big Ben, Parliament, Big Ben, Parliament, Big Ben, Parliament, around and around and around. Whatever's true, not whatever's false. It's so easy for us to think about things that aren't even true. Whatever's noble, not whatever's unimpressive. Noble is impressive. It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's sharp looking. Whatever's right, not whatever's wrong. Whatever's pure, not whatever's dirty. Whatever's lovely, not the speech that's ugly. No, whatever's admirable, not what's disreputable. Whatever's excellent, not anything inferior to that. Whatever's praiseworthy, not what's evil, but what would cause people to praise. Would you let your mind dwell on these things? This is the path to joy. This is the filter that we should have for our thoughts that leads us to a place of immense joy. And here's the great news about this is he says, you can get better at this. If you don't feel like you're good at it now, that's okay. You can get better at it. But like with anything that you get better at, what do you have to do to get better at it? You have to practice. And so he tells us that in verse 9. He says, whatever you have learned or received or heard from me, whatever you've seen in me, put it into practice. I don't know what you think about when you think about that word practice. Growing up, I was a huge sports fan. And so naturally, I think of this amazing press conference that has been viewed millions of times with who? With Allen Iverson. I can't think about it without thinking about Allen Iverson. He was one of my favorite players growing up. Allen Iverson gave hope to the small man. He was a little guy, but he played so huge on the court. And there's this one particular press conference where he just got fed up with the media. He was so tired of their questioning. He even admits, yes, I missed a practice. I did, okay? I was sick. I was hurt. I didn't feel like it. But he gets so fed up, and you remember what he says? He says, but we're not talking about a game. We're talking about practice. That's what we're talking about. And what's crazy about this clip is for 3 minutes, three solid minutes, he says the same thing over and over and over again. We're talking about practice. We're not even talking about the game. If it were the game, okay. But we're not talking about the game. We're talking about practice. I mean, come on, practice. It's practice. That's what we're talking about. For 3 minutes, he just says that. Now, there's a pretty significant difference between Allen Iverson and me. There's a pretty significant difference between Allen Iverson and you. And I'm not talking about on the basketball court. What I mean is, there are some people in life that they're just really good at something and they don't actually need to practice all the time. But you and I, when it comes to our thoughts, we're probably not included in that small group of people. No, we need to practice. Why? Because it's when you put the work in, the time in, the effort in, the practice, that the play in the game starts to change. And if you are wanting the game to change, but you're not willing to put in the practice, it's hard to do anything better or anything different in the game. And so if you want your mind to change, if you want the negativity to go away, if you want your mind to start focusing on the joy Paul talks about, you've got to put in the work. And it's the invisible practice that leads to the visible results. But you got to put in the practice. I'm talking about those moments when no one's there, when it's just you and your thoughts. Those moments when no one's around, when you're having all the imaginary conversations about what you should have said or what you would have said or what you hope would happen to them. It's in those moments that the practice matters. And that's what's so hard about this is we think, no, those don't really matter. It's just me and my thoughts. No, those matter greatly because it's those practices that will eventually lead or not lead to something different. You got to put in the practice. And look at this. He doesn't just say, oh, just practice because it'll make you better. No, he gives a promise. He attaches a promise to the practice. He says, whatever you've learned or received or heard from me or whatever you've seen in me, put it into practice and the God of peace will be with you. Now, this doesn't mean that when you're thinking about something else, anything that's evil or distorted or ugly or dirty, it doesn't mean that God is not there in that moment. He's there, but he's not bringing his peace. If you want to experience the peace that's promised, then you got to put in the practice. You've got to create that filter in your mind that runs all of your thoughts through. So what I want to do is I just want to give you, using what we learned from Paul in Philippians and in one other place in his writings, I want to give you just some real practical application on how you can do this, because this can be very ethereal. It can be very vague, and it can be difficult to grab a hold of and know what to do. And I would hate for any of us to leave this and not have anything we can do different. So I'm going to give you just three applications. Here's the first one. Take your thoughts captive. Paul says this in 2 Corinthians 10, in another letter that he writes. He says, we demolish every argument and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. Any argument, any pretension that sets itself up against, like I'm going to go up against the knowledge of God. Paul says, we take captive every thought and make it obedient to Christ. See, too often we treat our thoughts like a maitre d'. You've been to a restaurant where they've got just incredible service. You know, you walk in, they say, oh, we didn't realize you're going to be here. Do you have a reservation? We don't actually. So sorry. That's okay. Give us a moment. We'll make some space for you. Wonderful service. And some of us do the same thing with our brains. Anger, jealousy, bitterness, rage, the powerful foursome, the fearless foursome. Didn't know you were showing up tonight. I know you didn't have a reservation, but we're so glad you're here. Let's go make some room for you. And so we move some stuff out of the way and we make space in our minds for those things. No. We need to actually treat those thoughts more like this person would treat those thoughts. You know him, right? And I don't mean like Liam Neeson, the actor. I mean Liam Neeson in Taken. That's what I mean, okay? Where he leaves that voicemail, you know, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want. If you're looking for ransom, I can tell you I don't have money. But what I do have is a very particular set of skills. Skills that I have acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you. And if you let my daughter go now, that will be the end of it. I will not look for you. I will not pursue you. But if you do not, I will hunt you down. I will find you and I will kill you. That's the kind of treatment we ought to give our thoughts. Because these thoughts are real. These thoughts are powerful. They create emotion. They lead our lives. It's our operating system. So why would we not be vigilant with these thoughts? Who sent you? Why are you here? What's your goal in all of this? All right, I hear you. Come on in. We'll let you sit down for a minute, but you cannot stay long. No, we need to treat our thoughts with that kind of ruthlessness. We have to take every thought captive and make it obedient to Jesus. Secondly, we have to find the inputs. We have to find the inputs. What I mean by that is all of our thoughts have an origin. They all have a genesis. They come from somewhere. They come from someone. In fact, I had a friend that I was having this conversation with years ago, and I asked her, I said, hey, She travels a lot for business. So I was like, what do you do when you travel? She was like, that's interesting. You say that. I've actually been thinking a lot about that because my tendency is just to grab a magazine from one of the magazine stands, you know, this is a little bit of a dated example because who reads magazines these days, right? But she's like, I just would grab a magazine and I've just noticed that these magazines, you know, whether it's People or Esquire or Forbes or whatever they are, like, yeah, I mean, I enjoy reading them, and it's a little bit like candy, you know? Like, it's just hard to not enjoy it. But what I started realizing is it makes me compare my life over and over again to people that aren't experiencing the same thing I'm experiencing. I mean, yeah, okay, Brad and Angelina, that's cool that that's happening in their marriage, but that's not my marriage. You know, that's really cool that Ryan Gosling, it looks like that, but that's not really my life, you know? Which is very debatable, Ryan Gosling in general. I don't know. There's real mixed opinions about him, but I'll let you decide on what you imagine of Ryan Gosling. But you have to find the input. You got to find, hey, where's that comparison coming from? Comparison is the thief of all joy. So what's causing me to compare? And I'll tell you what it's not. It's definitely not social media, y'all. Social media is so positive, helpful, encouraging. Never once has that ever made anyone think less about their own life when they saw their best friend who just had a birthday party and didn't invite you to it. So that never happened. So you can take that one off the list. But there's some other inputs that might actually be worth thinking about. The people that I'm hanging around. The news sources that I'm exposing myself to. What am I reading? Who am I putting in my life? What voices am I allowing to have space in my head? Would you be willing to not only take your thoughts captive and go, who sent you? Why are you here? But would you also go, hey, where did you come from? What's this? Where was the input? Who sent you here? And then lastly, I want to give you one last application. And this one's actually directly from something Paul said in Philippians at the end in chapter 4. He says this. He says, verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always. I love this part. Again, I say rejoice. I've sung all the songs. I've read this verse dozens of times. But reading it in this context over the last few weeks, it's taken on a whole new meaning for me. And I've started to really feel like I'm tapping into the power of what this means, that we would rejoice in the Lord. Again, I say rejoice. Because it's like Paul knew, these people are going to be a little slow on the uptick. So I'm going to go ahead and say it again. Rejoice in the Lord always. No. Pay attention. Listen to me. Again, I'm serious. Rejoice. What does it mean? What does it mean to rejoice in the Lord? Let me just ask you, are there ever strategic, intentional moments in your day where you are rejoicing in the Lord? For those of you that are not Jesus followers, maybe a friend invited you, and maybe for you this is even difficult to understand because you're like, what does that even mean to rejoice in the Lord? That sounds like a Christian ease, you know? But for those of you that are following Jesus, this is an explicit command that he gives us. This is not a, hey, if you are up to it, if you're open to it, if you're interested in it. No, he's saying, hey, if you want to upgrade your mind, if you want to get on another level, if you want to get free from the trap of negativity, you have to, at some point in your day, at some point, as strategic as you would be about eating or about working out or about your latest Netflix binge or at showing up to work, you've got to plan out some time to rejoice in the Lord, because it's in the rejoicing that we have to replace the negative thoughts, because our mind can only think about one thing at one time. And it's in that moment that the negativity is almost repelled by the rejoicing. I saw this yesterday in a really profound way that I probably haven't really emotionally gotten over, but about 2 weeks ago, it was actually the day before Kobe died. A mentor of mine passed away. And so I was mourning Kobe's death in a whole different way because of what it reminded me about this particular mentor of mine who had passed away. His name is Reggie Campbell, and I wasn't the only one who was mentored by him. No, he has been leading mentoring groups for the last 20 years, and he actually created a system called Radical Mentoring that a lot of our churches actually use, that because of the system that he's created, over 12,000 men have been through a radical mentoring group. So this is a man who had immense impact with his life. And I sat there yesterday at his memorial service, listening to his wife, Miriam, listening to his son, Ross, listening to his daughter, Erin, listening to some other friends of his talk about what a remarkable person he was. One of them talked about some of the last few sentences that he said just before he passed away. They said we could hear him with confidence. Not even really, he had been muttering things, but this was clear with confidence that he said, I'm just amazed that he saved me. He changed my life, and I cannot wait to see him. And as I sat there yesterday, honestly, this is terrible. My first thought was like, oh gosh, I don't know what I'm going to mutter when I'm not even really conscious and I'm just saying things, you know? Like, isn't that a little scary that people are like, wait, what? That's what you really were all about? Like, that's weird. Why are you saying that now? But when I was listening to that, I just thought, God, I want that so badly. I want your joy to be so deep in me, in my heart and in my mind, that the last thing that I would say would speak to your joy, would be to rejoice in you. I just can't believe that he would save me. He changed my life. I just can't wait to see him. And so last night I practiced this. I know it was cold outside, but I was like, I'm going to give this a go. And I'm telling you, it's powerful. I went on, I don't know if it's okay to call it a joy walk, but for about 30, 45 minutes, I just went outside and it had already gotten dark, which I thought that was a little safer. I don't mean like safer, like safety wise, but I was going in. I mean, I'm like out loud, hands in the air, walking around our neighborhood, just going, God, you are amazing. You're good. You're kind. You're faithful. You're a hiding place. You're a refuge. I can't believe you saved me. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sure people were like, hey, there's a crazy man who's talking to himself outside, hands in the air. It's pretty bizarre. But I'm telling you, there is something powerful about choosing to rejoice in the Lord. And if you want to escape the trap of negativity, I'm telling you, you can try to read every book you want on positivity. You can try to choose the power of positivity. You can try to upgrade your mind, start thinking more positive thoughts. But I think doing what Paul did and fixing your eyes on the cross, I think it's the best way. I love what the author of Hebrews wrote, chapter 12. He said, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders us, including our thoughts and the sin that so easily entangles us. And let's fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him. I love that. That Jesus had joy set before him. It's almost like in the background of the cross was the word joy. And he's going, I can go to the cross, as awful as it may be, as much of a sacrifice as it may be, I can go there because of joy. And for the joy set before him, he endured the cross and he scorned its shame. Let's consider him who took on such opposition from sinful men so that we don't grow weary and lose heart. I'm telling you, the best way to escape the trap of negativity is to fix your eyes onto what Jesus did. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. You know what his joy was? You. That was his joy. His joy was his love for you. His love for Reggie. His love for Paul. You know, Paul was sitting there in that Roman prison writing this letter. You know what eventually happened to him? They think he's there for about 2 years. He finally gets out of prison and they decide to execute him. And the fear that he felt, it was real. He was going to lose his life. He did lose his life for this. But he kept his eyes fixed. He kept his eyes fixed on the cross. And God allowed him to escape the trap of negativity. And that's my hope for you. In fact, that's my prayer for you. Some of you, the best thing that you could do is right when we're done here. I know a lot of you are watching this message and you're not in our building, but if you're in the building right now, I would just love to invite you in a little room that we have called the studio. We've got a group of people that are there that just want to pray for you. And maybe you're going through a tough season. Maybe you're not. Maybe you're going through a great season. Maybe you've got a new marriage, or maybe you got a new job, or maybe you've got a new lease on life, or maybe you've got something that's really holding you back. I would love to invite you to go allow them the privilege of praying for you, because our hope, our prayer, is that God would allow us to escape the trap of negativity by fixing our eyes on him. For the joy set before him, he took on the cross, and so can you. Heavenly Father, I recognize these are just words, and I'm not a psychologist. My ability to even understand the brain is so small. But God, I'm just banking on what Paul said, that there is power. There is peace. There is a promise when we rejoice in the Lord. And so I pray that every single one of us in our own way would make time to do that. Maybe it's by reading Philippians. Maybe it's by going on some kind of walk. Maybe it's by having a conversation with someone. Maybe it's allowing someone to pray for us. But I just look forward to the day when your church is made up of positive, forward-thinking, can-do, hope-filled, anything-is-possible kind of people. Just like you've allowed us to be for so many generations. And we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Hey, thanks so much for being with us today. I hope you have an awesome Sunday. We'll see you back here next week. Thanks.